It's good seeing you tonight. Over the last few weeks, I'll say 2 weeks, we've been looking at Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 9. And so, as Paul Harvey would say, I want to finish up tonight and tell the rest of the story. And so, what I'd like to do is to read from verse 1 through 6 to you tonight, and then look at verse 7 through 9. Now, I don't want to get in too deeply to verses 1 through 6 because we've looked at that, and if you have any interest in what I have to say about it, the sermons are on the webpage. If you really want to study it, I can recommend some books from guys who really know what they're talking about. So we'll begin in verse 1. And for me, this is the best passage to talk about really how Christians view the playing out of history, and in particular the end of history as we would understand it, and the signs really of the end. So let me begin reading to you in verse 1 again, and it goes like this. It says, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand." Now, we understand that to be the ministry of really Christ, and so this binding really happened in the ministry of Christ, and we looked at some passages in the New Testament that talks about how the ministry of Christ really bound Satan. Remember how Jesus said that when he was accused of casting out demons because he was a demon in the name of Beelzebub, Jesus said, no, that's not the way it works. You can't raid a strong man's house unless you tie up the strong man. And that's what's going on here. Essentially, Jesus says, I have bound Satan, or I couldn't be casting out demons and disrupting his kingdom. And so we believe that that was going on in the life of in the ministry of Jesus. Now, verse 2, he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and he cast him to a bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him. And again, that's a lot of symbolic language because Satan's a spirit, and what's a bottomless pit? Really, if you think about it, what is that, a black hole? It has no bottom in it. So he throws him in the pit, and for 1,000 years he's fallen, but he's a spirit, and you know, there's some symbolism here. The 1,000 years, if this 1,000 was literally 1,000 years, and again, we've talked about that in the previous two sessions. From my understanding, this would be the first time in the Bible that 1,000 meant literally 1,000. And we looked at a lot of those passages where 1,000 is always a symbolic number for a long or a period of time or a large number. So he lays hold, he binds him for a very long period of time and sets a seal on him. Why? So that he shall deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years, till the long period of time is up. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. Very important there is that he is bound, or he is limited, so that he can deceive the nations no more. It's a very important clause because that's repeated twice more. The emphasis is he's bound so that he can't carry on his deception. Now why is that deception so important? And if you think about it, in the Garden of Eden, God's perfect will is for us to have lived in the Garden of Eden, right? God's perfect will is that you and I would have been born in the Garden of Eden, because his perfect will was that no sin would enter the world. That was his perfect will. It's not his will that any should sin, not his will that any should be lost. But it was the deception of Satan with Eve that came in and disrupted God's perfect will. He calls Israel as a nation. And in Genesis chapter 12, the calling of Israel was really fourfold. One of the characteristics of God's call on Israel was that they should bless the world. Now, ultimately, they did bless the world in that they were the family of Jesus who blesses the world. But from my understanding, in the perfect will of God, Israel as a nation would have been able to spread the gospel or the message of Yahweh throughout the world and bless the world through the knowledge of Yahweh. Now that happened to some degree. It happened in Babylon to some degree. It happened when they were slaves in Egypt to some degree, but never to the degree that it should have. And the reason why was because Israel couldn't go more than two or three generations without reverting back to idol worship. And when you think about how Moses talked about idol worship, he called idols devils. And it's interesting that when you look at, for instance, the book of Hosea, when you look at the first part of Ezekiel, Israel just didn't choose to follow idols, but the language is that of seduction. They were led away. They were seduced by idols or demons. And so, but they could never, that they never fulfilled God's perfect will for them. Why? Through the deception of Satan. And so now you have the creation of the church. I'm re-preaching these things, aren't I? I'll move fast here. Now you have the creation of the church, and where Satan had disrupted and really destroyed God's plan for the Garden of Eden, where he had really, in many ways, inhibited God's complete plan for Israel to play out. Now there is a limitation put on Satan where he cannot do to the church what he did to Israel and to the garden. So that he can deceive or through widespread deception halt the spread of the gospel. Now he deceives. Satan does many things. He can destroy lives. Satan can tempt. There's many things Satan is doing and can do, but there is a sense in which he is on a chain and cannot do all that he would like to do. Cannot do all that he would like to do. He cannot stop the spread of the gospel into the world as he would like to do. And so he is bound. Now, in verse 4, and I'll move quickly, I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was given to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witnesses to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received his mark. Their foreheads are on their hands. They lived and they reigned with Christ 1,000 years. So the assumption is that while Satan is bound and the gospel is spreading, he cannot deceive on earth like he would like. He is limited. He cannot do what he would like to do. Although as a dog is on a chain, if you get within the radius of his chain, he can do tremendous damage to you. Jesus is reigning in heaven, and his saints are reigning with him. And we looked at Acts chapter 2 and 1 Corinthians 15 last Sunday, which I think are very, very important because they paint a picture of Jesus reigning that's not a period of worldwide peace, and that's very, very important. Because oftentimes when we think of the reign of Jesus, we make certain assumptions and we say, well, if Jesus is reigning, if he's really on the throne, if he's really in control, then why are these things happening? He must not really be reigning or in control like we had hoped that he would be. But there is coming a time when he will reign and then everything will be perfect. But again, 1 Corinthians 15 says that he will reign until he has put all of his enemies under his feet. And then the last enemy which is destroyed, which is death. After death is destroyed, then he will take the kingdom and then he will deliver it up to the Father, and he will be subject to the Father in the kingdom. So ultimately it's going to be the Father's kingdom, and he's going to reign until all of his enemies are destroyed, the last one being death. So that's not a reign of peace, because all during the reign of Jesus he has enemies. And he will reign till he has defeated all of his enemies. And you have that in Acts chapter 2 where the quote is made, which is a David quote, but Peter brings it up where it says, my Lord said to his Lord. So his Lord was Jesus, my Lord, the Father. My Lord said to his Lord something another, but sit here until your enemies are made your footstool. His Lord said to my Lord. I got that mixed up, but you go look at that in Acts chapter 2. But again, he's reigning till his enemies are made his footstool. So this reign is happening. And then in verse 5, but the rest of the dead did not live again until the 1,000 years were finished. And there's a lot going on here with this resurrection, but that's another two sermons, okay? This is the first resurrection. Verse 6, blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ and shall reign with him 1,000 years. So the ideal is that Satan is bound. He is limited so that he cannot stop the spread of the gospel as he would like. And at this time, Christ is reigning in heaven. It's a spiritual kingdom until all of his enemies are made his footstool. But then the rest of the story. Because in verse 7, it says that Satan is going to be released. Whatever is inhibiting him, whatever is binding him, whatever chain he is on, whatever limitation that he has had so that he cannot do all that he would like to do, is going to be released from him at the end. Verse 7, now when the 1,000 years have expired, or when this long period of Satan's binding is expired, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. Now again, I don't know how many sands are in the sea, but we're talking imagery here. It means a whole lot more than you could count. And they went up to the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. I just want you to see that here, because there's two things that are happening. Before Christ comes back, because verse 11 and 15 in this chapter, if we were to go on down, is about the final judgment. So before Christ comes back and institutes the final judgment, it says that for a period of time, Satan is going to be able to move in a way that he has not moved since Christ came. That's my understanding. If he's bound by Christ, if he's put under limitations by Christ, at the end, before Christ comes back, he is going to be released in a way that he is going to be more ferocious and more powerful than he had been previously. And notice two things are going to happen. The first is that he's going to go out and he's going to gather all the nations, or he's going to gather all the forces together and bring some sort of unity to them, which are referred to as Gog and Magog here. And there's a quote on the screens here by William Barclay. You can put that up. What does he mean by Gog and Magog? And William Barclay says, but here we find a picture which etched itself deeply, if mysteriously, on Jewish thought. The picture of Gog and Magog, we find it first in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And there, Gog of the land of Magog is to launch the great attack on Israel, and in the end, it is to be utterly destroyed. It may be that originally Gog was connected with the Scythians, whose invasion everyone feared. As time went on, in Jewish thought, Gog and Magog came to stand for everything that is against God. And I think that's a good way of putting it. So it's saying here, Satan is going to be released, and he's going to go out and he's going to gather together all the forces that are not of God, and he's going to turn them against the camp of the saints and the beloved city. Now, so in other words, the non-Christians and the false Christians, the non-Christians and the false Christians are going to somehow be organized to turn together against the beloved city, which almost means Jerusalem. But then the question is, which Jerusalem? And the Church of God has always looked at Hebrews chapter 12, if you can put that up, as the city, because you have playing out in the New Testament. There is a literal Jerusalem, but the church is often referred to as the New Jerusalem. Here in Hebrews it says, "For you have not come to a mountain that may be touched and that burned with fire, or to blackness and darkness or tempest." And he's referring to when Israel would come to the Mount Sinai here. And verse 19, "And the sound of a trumpet and the voice of the word showed that those who heard it begged that the word should not be spoken to them anymore." Verse 22, "But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven, to God the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect." And I'll stop there, but notice that there's a literal Jerusalem, but there is also a city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, which is the church of God. It's the church. And I understand that this passage then means that when Satan is released from what inhibits him from doing his worst, that he is going to gather the forces that are not Christian or that are false Christian and gather them and direct them towards the true church, the true servants of God. You also have Galatians 5, verse 25 and 26 that talks about the New Jerusalem. So then the question is that where we are today? And that's a question of speculation. If you think about it, that's a question of speculation. So let me make the case against the fact that we are there today, and then let me try to make the case for the ideal that maybe we're in the time when Satan has been released. The case against the ideal that we are now living in the time when Satan has been released or given more power or control by God to do what he previously could not do. A strong case that you might make against the fact that we are there yet is the spread of the gospel. Because if Satan is primarily limited in that he cannot stop the spread of the gospel, the march of the church, the intent of God in this age, if that's what he can't do, then you would have some grounds to say that maybe he's still bound in a way. Because if you look at it, Africa, 9 million Christians in 1900, and 2000, 380 million Christians. Now again, you know, the other question is, when you see all these numbers about how many Christians there are, you have to ask, are those really Christians, right? And that enters into another scenario, because, for instance, when they say there's like 2.1 billion Christians in the world, they say that 80% of America is Christian. And that would be a little hard to buy. I mean, Greenville, we're in the Bible Belt, right? Do you think 80% of Greenville is Christian? And so, 2.1 billion. They have, those numbers always have, they count the kids who are baptized by the Roman Catholic Church. So Mexico's always 90 to 95% Christian when they count, get to the 2.1 billion. Do you really think 9 out of 10 Mexicans are Christian? So, you know, how you define it is important, and that's one of the scary things. You probably, the Muslim numbers of 1.6 or 1.7 billion are probably closer to being right than the fact that there are 2.1 million, 1 billion legitimate Christians. And that's sort of the thing. If you get down to the bare numbers there, it gets a little trickier. But in spite of that, the gospel has spread tremendously in Africa in the last 100 years. And the World Christian Encyclopedia says that by 2025 that they expect there to be over 600 million Christians in Africa. So they expect it to go from about 400 million to 600 million over a 25-year period. You look at what is happening in China, And there was a headline in the UK Telegraph a couple of years ago, and it says, China is on course to become the world's most Christian nation in 15 years. The number of Christians in communist China is growing so rapidly that by 2013, it will have more churchgoers than America has. Oh, granted, they got a lot more people than we have, but I mean, it's an amazing thing going on in China, given that in 1945, they counted less than 1 million Christians in the nation. So there is a sense in which the gospel is still spreading rapidly and pushing itself forcefully. I was looking at this article put out in 2013 by Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary on the top 20 countries where Christianity is growing the fastest. The top 20 countries where Christianity is growing the fastest. Number one is Nepal, which is growing at a rate of about 11%. It's primarily Hindu. Number two is China. And number three, four, five, six, and seven caught me off guard, because this is not what you would gather if you watch the news. But the third country where Christianity is growing the fastest is the United Arab Emirates. The fourth is Saudi Arabia. The fifth is Qatar. The sixth is Oman. The seventh is Yemen. Those are all Muslim-dominated countries, and Christianity is growing by about 8% a year in those countries, according to this report, which is a significant report from a reputable place. Number eight is Mongolia, which is Buddhist primarily. Number nine is Cambodia, which is Buddhist. Number 10 is Bahrain, which is Muslim. And so even with the persecution, even in the Middle East, from what we understand, the gospel is pushing into those regions in spite of significant opposition. Now, in America, church attendance over the last 25 years has declined from about 45% to 25%. I don't know that most Christians realize that we're in a major recession, and over the last 25 years in America, there's about 60 million people that used to go to church 25 years ago that don't go to church anymore. I mean, when 45% of the population used to go to church and it's down to 25, you're talking about a 60% drop over the last 25 years. It's been significant in America. But worldwide, it continues to grow. The gospel continues to go forward. And so if you looked at that, you could say, well, Satan still seems to have certain limitations put on him. He can't stop the spread of the gospel as maybe he would like. But then if you try to say, well, maybe he is released though. Maybe we really are entering into these last days when he has been released, and the things that he wished he could have done, he can now do. Because if you look at things from the other side, you would have to say, it does look like, if you look at it through a certain glass, that the forces that don't like Christianity are getting together in ways they haven't got together before. It does seem like there's something unifying forces that don't even particularly care for each other. And the only unifying factor that they tend to have is that they don't like Christians. I mean, the gospel is growing in Islamic countries, according to this study. But in the last 25, 30 years, the religion of Islam, and you can try to distinguish between the religion or the extremist depending on where you are politically, I guess you would try to draw lines there. But in Iraq, for instance, in 1987, which was the last census in Iraq, there was 1.4 million Christians. Now, that was 30 years ago, and they haven't taken a census since. What they think is in 2006, there were less than 500,000 Christians left in Iraq. So it's declined by 300%. And when ISIS took Iraq, the northern part of Iraq, 2 years ago, the Christians were told to convert or die or pay a tax of $470 per family, which is a pretty significant tax if you live in Iraq. Not too bad in Greene County, but if you're living in Iraq, that's a pretty significant, that's a hefty tax to pay. Currently, according to Reuters, which is not a Christian polling place, there's about 100 million Christians that are under significant persecution in the world today. And probably, I think, most of those live in Islamic countries, that that's where the persecution is coming from. Now, where the Islamic factions, the Islamic extremists, did you have this? I don't remember having this 25, 30 years ago. I might have been neglectful of the news because I was only six, but I don't remember this level of persecution, this level of hostility coming from the Islamic thinkers against the Christian thinkers. I may have missed something, but I don't remember that being the case even 15, 20 years ago. And I realize that American foreign policy with the invasion of Iraq that started something that has had some dominoes. But the hostility seems to be growing and significant. You think about communism, you know, for years, you know, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, Russia was seen as very increasingly pro-Christian, right? And Christianity got into Russia, and it was seen as a new frontier, and Christianity has grown in Russia. But are you familiar with the Yuravaya laws that were passed in July of this year? Just 5 months ago, this is what happened in Russia. And I'm talking about, you know, communism here, although they wouldn't claim to be communists. They're closer to it than we are. But this is what happened. This is what passed in Russia 5 months ago. It requires that all missionaries now in Russia have permits. They made house churches illegal. They limited religious activity only to registered church buildings. You now have to get registered with the government to have a church building. And individuals who disobey will be fined up to $780 and organizations up to $15,000. The new laws, it says, will create conditions for the repression of all Christians. Any person who mentions their religious view or reflections out loud or puts them in writing without the proper documents could be accused of illegal missionary activity now in Russia. And the requiring a permit to evangelize is not only absurd and offensive, but also creates the basis for mass persecution of believers for violating these provisions. One of the leaders in the Protestant church said, he said, this is the most anti-religious bill in Russia since Khrushchev. 50 years ago. Well, 60 years ago. So there is this closing in Russia. With all that is going on in China today, and we talk about how Christianity is growing, but there was an article in the New York Times last year that talked about how China is significantly coming down on Christians in ways that they had never done before, and many of the missionaries are reconsidering whether they want to work in China now because the Chinese government is really coming down on them. And that's in the New York Times. This isn't something that the Christians are just trying to be an alarmist about. So you've got Islam, and now the communist or the former communist countries, you could say they're making a turn back hard against Christianity. You come to America, and you could ask the question, who in America is defending the Christians except the Christians? What about Hollywood? I was looking at the old decency codes that govern Hollywood between about 1934 to 1960. Remember, they made in the 20s, the movies were getting so racy that they had to write decency codes that govern what could be in a movie for 25 years. And there are 11 things that could not be in a movie from 1934 into the late 50s. There are a lot of things that may or may not have to be, but there are 11 things that you could not have in a movie. And number one was profanity, which included the words God, Lord, Jesus, or Christ, except in a reverent manner. And I like number 10. You could not ridicule a clergy member in a movie for 25 years. Isn't that nice? You could not paint a clergy member in a negative light, or it was a violation of the Hollywood code. Think Hollywood has anything like that today? No. There was a study done 10 years ago, and all the representations of Christianity on TV, and they found out that CBS treated Christianity the best. 47% of the representations were positive, so over half were negative. The WB network was second. They represented Christianity positively 41% of the time. ABC was at 37, NBC was at 27, and Fox was at 27%. So, you know, Hollywood has not been kind to Christianity. And I've seen studies that show, like, you know, on primetime, like NBC, 80% of the representations of Christianity are negative. You don't have a lot of good Christians being represented in movies anymore. They don't seem to be all that pro-Christian, do they? Media doesn't seem to be all that pro-Christian. Big business. I mean, it was amazing a couple years ago when the CEO of Starbucks said, essentially, if you don't like our stance or moral issues, don't buy coffee from us. I mean, who would say something like that? Because he was talking about where Christians disagreed with them on the issue of homosexuality. He said, if you don't like where we are on homosexuality, don't buy coffee from us. We don't need your business. Now, you have Chick-fil-A, which is positive towards Christianity, but even the businesses seem to be so positive anymore. You've got higher education, which is in many ways becoming hostile to Christianity. There's been a lot of studies, and you know, I won't go into that, you know, Ivy League colleges are not a place that is very friendly to Christians anymore. A lot of colleges aren't very friendly to Christians anymore. I remember being at UNCA in the late 90s and getting ripped apart by a class full of students because I wrote a paper. I got ripped apart. They weren't nice at all. I wrote a paper that said fathers might be important after all. Writing that fathers have something to contribute to the upbringing of their children that maybe the children can't get from two women, and maybe a father would have something to contribute, and I got ripped to shreds. I still remember, still have scars from that meeting. Politics. I mean, which political party is really defending Christianity? And I don't want to get into politics because that's where you get stoned. But I'll give two examples and then an overarching example. 2012, there was a major political party, and you'll know which one I'm talking about. And they wanted to put God in the platform of their convention. And it got booed. And they passed it, but it was clearly, there were enough boos to have kept God out of the platform. They brought his name up and said, we want to put God in the platform of our convention. And it got booed down, but they went with it anyway. I mean, that's pretty radical, isn't it? But if you think about it, both political parties don't stand up for Christians and the rights of Christians nearly as much as they probably should. I was read an article the other day, and it was talking about, you know, when the political party wants to draw the line in the sand, they threaten to shut down the government. Like, this is so important to us, we're going to shut down the government if you don't pass this law, or you know, we'll cut off funding, we will shut down, you know, we'll stop payment, we'll shut down the government. And the guy was just pointing out that all the times both political parties have threatened to shut down the government, it's always about money. They never threaten to shut down the government on anything moral in nature. Never moral in nature. It's never about abortion or rights or violence or pornography or anything that could be remotely considered a Christian value. It's always about money. It's always about taxes, only about tax cuts. And they go in and say, well, we're going to shut down the government. Never do that for the moral stuff. Never go to bat. And so, you know, the question is who's defending the Christians but the Christians? I mean, now you can make a case that there are groups, organizations that are, but it does get pretty thin. And it's funny how you start to see such strange bedfellows developing in our current culture. You look at Hollywood and the media, who seem to be very aggressive in defending the Islamic religion. That's a very strange bedfellow. I saw a study by Pew Research, which is a significant research group. In 2013, they went into 35 Islamic countries and polled them extensively and to find out what the Muslims believe in. And they asked them lots and lots of questions, but five caught my attention. They asked Muslim individuals, first question, is drinking alcohol immoral? Is it immoral to drink alcohol? 7% said that it wasn't. 93% said that it was immoral to drink alcohol. Is abortion moral? This is the Muslim. Is it moral to have an abortion? 5% said yes. That it was a moral thing to do. 95% said it was immoral to have an abortion. Is sex outside of marriage immoral? 93% of Muslims said yes, sex outside of marriage is immoral. Is homosexual behavior moral? 97% of Muslims said no. 3% says yes, it's a moral activity, it's not wrong. Must a wife always obey her husband? 77% of Muslims said yes. Does Western entertainment hurt morality? 66% said, yes, it does. It's just strange bedfellows because you run that in Hollywood, it goes all the way back the other way. On issues of drinking or sex outside of marriage or abortion or homosexuality or women's rights, they're completely on the other side of the spectrum. How do those two get together? Strange that they would get together at this time in history, and at least the liberal, Hollywood would be so defensive of these individuals who have absolutely nothing in common with them. So you start to look at it and you say, I mean, if you were to say this is Satan has been released, you would say, wow, there's a coming together of groups that used to not come together. They seem to have one thing in common, which is that they're not particularly crazy about Christians. It's interesting in Revelation 13, 16 through 17, if you put it up. was talking about the mark of the beast, and we talked about the mark of the beast last week and how, you know, yeah, the mark on the head and the mark on the hand, and that runs into Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4 through 9, where the Jewish individuals would show their allegiance to the law or show their dedication to the law by taking scripture passages, putting them in boxes and putting them on their foreheads or on their hands. And Matthew chapter 23, verse 5, I believe it's referred to as phylacteries. And the Pharisees like to have really big boxes, you know, to show they were really dedicated to the law. So verse 16 and 17 says, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hands or on their foreheads. It's interesting. Why do you need the mark? Verse 17, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark of the beast or the number of his name. Now, there's perhaps a spiritual application in that, but if you take it sort of at face value, they're saying you need the mark, or you need to demonstrate that you are dedicated to us or committed, as you would wear the phylactery on the head and the hand, to show that you are completely dedicated to the law and the law of God. Unless you demonstrate that you are dedicated to us and to the doctrines that we teach or to the teachings that we have, you can't buy or sell. And so, but you think about what goes on in America, and I know I'm probably sounding like a nut at this point in the sermon. But it's interesting what you see sometimes, and maybe you make too much of it, what evolves in America, in that there is a sense in which if you don't demonstrate that you are with them, there's a sense in which they're saying you can't buy or sell. Now, in first century with Caesar, the mark would be worship of Caesar. Everybody had to line up and they had to take a pinch of incense and they had to throw it in the fire one time a year and say, Caesar is Lord. You know, and that's what the Christians had to face in that day, because they refused to sacrifice to Caesar, and that basically put them out of polite society, put them out of the culture, because they would not sacrifice and say, Caesar is Lord. But you look at America and you look at what's going on sometimes, and you say, well, what's the mark in our culture? You see when you read the news that unless you adhere to an anti-God, anti-scripture doctrine, it's increasingly becoming, and it's just around the fringes, but there is a price to pay in regards to buying and selling. I mean, think about that Aaron and Melissa Klein. They refused to bake a cake for a wedding that they didn't want, and they got put out of business. It's like you can't buy or sell here, right? $135,000 fine because you refused to do a cake for a wedding that you didn't think God would approve of. Think about that. You can't buy or sell. You got to go out of business here. You can't run a baking company. You can't buy or sell. You can't do business unless you let us know that you agree with us. Remember that picture taking Elaine's photography down in Santa Fe? Got sued for $7,000 because she refused to do pictures for a wedding that she didn't think was very godly, that God wouldn't approve of. It's like, yeah, every time you do it, you're going to get fined $7,000. You can't take pictures in this town. You can't buy or sell in this town unless you let us know that you agree with us on this issue. Remember Brendan Eich? Brendan Eich was in the news maybe 2 years ago. He was the CEO of Mozilla. CEO of Mozilla. And it's been at least 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. He gave $1,000 to Proposition 8, which passed in California, which made same-sex marriage illegal. And he gave $1,000 in support of that, as many, many other people did. And unless he renounced the $1,000 and said he had made a mistake, which he didn't do, he lost his job. It's like, no, you can't work here. You can't buy or sell here unless you tell us you agree with us. The Atlanta police chief, Kelvin Cochran, lost his job. He's the police chief of Atlanta. This is what he wrote that caused him to lose his job. He wrote a little book called Who Told You That You Were Naked? And in defining uncleanness, this is what he wrote that cost him his job. He said, whatever is opposite of purity, including sodomy, homosexuality, lesbianism, bestiality, and all other forms of sexual perversion. And he refused to stand up and renounce it, and he lost his job. It's like, no, you can't work here anymore. You can't buy or sell here. This couple, Chip and Joanna Gaines, is on the news. They're on HGTV and for fixer-uppers. I think they're going to keep their job, even though they go to a church where the preacher said some things regarding sexuality that the media doesn't like. It looks like they're going to keep their jobs, but the Benham boys, remember them? They had a job lined up with HGTV, but they lost it when people found out what they believed in the issue of same-sex marriage. State magistrates were told to either conduct marriages they didn't approve of or resign, leave, get out of here, you can't buy or sell. John Roberts, when this case went forward legalizing same-sex marriage, says this. He said the First Amendment guarantee, now this is John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court when this passed, but this is what he said. He said the First Amendment guarantees, however, the freedom to exercise religion. Ominously, that is not a word the majority uses. Hard questions arise when people of faith exercise religion in ways that may be seen to conflict with the new right to same-sex marriage. When, for example, a religious college provides marriage student housing only to opposite-sex married couples, or a religious adoption agency declines to place children with same-sex married couples. Indeed, the Solicitor General candidly acknowledged that the tax exemptions of such religious organizations would be in question if they oppose same-sex marriage. There's little doubt that these and similar questions will soon be before the court. Unfortunately, people of faith can take no comfort in the treatment they receive from the majority today. Just think about that. Maybe I'm a conspiracy theorist, I don't know. I guess we are in one way or another, right? But as you look at the news, you see, and maybe things are going to be different going forward, I don't know, but you see, it's like, no, you got to tell us you agree with us, or it's going to cost you financially. You got to, no, you got to renounce that. You have to publicly say that you're with us on that thing, or you can't work at Mozilla. No, you have to publicly say you're with us, or you can't run a bakery in this town. We're going to sue you out of business. You can't buy or sell here unless you're with us. So you say, are we living in those last days when Satan has been released? Well, in one sense, the gospel's really still going forward, and you could make the case he's bound. But there is a sense in which you look, and maybe you have to be, you know, look at the, you know, it all depends on if it's in the eye of the beholder. There is a sense on a given day when you look at the news, it's like all the Christian groups, all the non-Christian groups seem to be rallying together. And as a Christian, you look and you say, how many people who aren't Christians are supportive of Christians? Because it used to be Hollywood was for Christians, politicians were for Christians, higher education was for Christians. Most of the Ivy League colleges were started as Christian colleges. Religion, I mean, the political parties, Hollywood used to be for us. Higher education used to be for us. The Muslims used to not want to kill us as badly as they do. You know, there's a lot of people that were pro-Christian. Again, does it seem like the camp of the saints is being surrounded? That's the question. Good news here, if you consider it good news, is that At some point, you're going to feel surrounded, but Jesus is going to show up. It says, verse 8, and he will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is of the sand of the sea. They went up on the breadth and of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. That's pretty good news, I guess. I guess you shouldn't be happy that fire devoured anybody. But I think that's meant there to be good news, that there may be a surrounding of the church. The church may feel squeezed in ways that it hadn't before. The church may feel like we don't have a friend in the world. The church may feel pushed from society. The church may feel like, you know, this can't go on another 5 or 10 years, or I don't know, any of us are going to be alive. But I said, God's not going to let that happen. The fire comes down, and whether, I don't know what kind of fire that is. I think that's a fire of judgment. Fire is going to come down, and it's going to save the Christians. And in verse 10, it says, and the devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and they will be tormented day and night forever and forever. Amen. Hallelujah. I'm finished. You still like me, don't you? Okay. All right. We're fine. All right. You got to love me. You can't get to heaven if you don't. You're only allowed to hate the devil. All right. All right. Let's stand. I'm going to dismiss you.